long, long day. I got a lot to say. It feels like I'm carrying a two-ton weight. I go to see a friend.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Patrick Winslow.
And I am Father Matthew Kauth.
And we are speaking from the rooftop.
A podcast brought to you by Tan Books, in which we invite you to join our conversation out here in the open air,
where we look out upon the world around us from the rooftop of the church and share with you what we see.
Makes me wanna scream from the rooftop to the screen till I know.
Hello, Father Winslow.
Well, hello, dear Father.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
You know, that's another one of those words that conveys so much meaning depending upon how one says it. Is that not true? Like
true.
When you say to someone that has been scorned, what's the matter? Nothing. I'm fine.
That's true. But it is a wonderful social lubricant.
It is.
Because it gets you by without lying.
That's true. That's true.
Right?
It's a very fine word.
It's fine. I've used it many a time.
Indeed.
That's a really good interest. That's an interesting topic right there. Right to know something.
The right to know something.
Yeah, you know, I think we've talked about it in the context of formation. When people inquire about your life, it seems just a little too personal, and yet you want to be honest because, you know, you want to be honest. And at what point are you being dishonest if you don't divulge more personal items? Or for example, can you sort of just only answer to a certain degree, even though it's slightly deceptive?
Right.
It's almost like I'm talking to a moral theologian. I like to tell people that I have friends who are good moral theologians. I call them for all my loopholes.
That's right. Yeah, I'm a little stickler on some of these things, though. That's a good one. You know, there was a line that St. Philip Neri used to use a lot. We just had his feast day not long ago. He got from the Song of Songs, which is segreto meum mihi, which is just my secret is my own. And he would use that principally about those things that were most intimate to him relative to his prayer life or to sort of what was going on in his interior life in any way, shape, or form. But he would do it with a sort of smile, as the reports say, in such a way that people didn't feel as if they were being shut down, but that there was something that was precious to him that he wasn't going to let out. And as priests, I think that one of the things that strikes me relative to our own interior life, for better or for worse, is that the faithful are always getting it. Like they're always receiving whatever's going on.
Yeah.
Because what else do I have to give them? Mm-hmm. You know, the Dominican motto is contemplata aliis tradere, which is to hand on to others what you yourself have contemplated. And so,
did you always speak Klingon so well? Or is that Latin with a Klingon accent?
That's what it is. On a big forehead. The idea is that you're handing on what you've seen, right? What you've contemplated, what you've studied, etc. And so clearly what one is receiving relative to homilies and things of that nature is something
deeply interior.
About your interior.
Yeah.
And even that you have to be sort of careful because it's the faith you're trying to reveal.
Right, not
and
yourself.
Yet it's not without you and the way in which you're affected by it. But relative to
just like the regular circumstance of the door.
Yeah.
Right. So, or like at the door of the church, someone says, "Oh, Father, how are you?" "Oh, I'm fine." Or one of our seminarians, they're visiting for the weekend. "Hey, you know, how are you? What's your name? Where are you from?"
Right.
So what was it like in college for you? Or did you date? And suddenly it takes a turn toward the personal.
Right.
And these young men, you know, they're young. They want to be honest and sincere. But at the same time, at some point, do you just not answer or do you deflect? What is the right amount of depth for certain conversations? It's a certain art, I would imagine.
Well, I think that the example you like to use of the onion is a good one. I mean, there are different layers that people should have access to, and no one has a right to force a layer. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything wrong with even doing so in a sort of kindly, and that's why I brought up Philip Neri, furtive or jocular way, to say, if someone said to you, did you date a lot when you were in high school? Oh, Lord have mercy. It's been, for me, if someone asked me that, I'd be like, it's been so many years I couldn't possibly remember. Right.
I'd have to check a yearbook. Exactly. I don't know.
I mean, you can deflect it in a nice right, way to say right. you just crossed a line there that I'm not going to come across as didn't
greet yeah. you on. And well, sometimes it goes the other way, right? Where you say, hey, how are you? And they really tell you.
Yes.
And you know, this was just a social way to say, I care about you, but I'm not interested in hearing about it right now, right? We don't really mean that. People just mean to check in generally, not specifically.
Well, it's true. And that's, again, what you use that phrase, social lubricant, because you're trying to treat other people with the same sort of relative kindness that you would treat a friend. But the language doesn't mean the same thing as when you say it to a friend.
Right.
So if I say to you, when you just arrived at seminary, how are you? I don't expect to receive just fine.
Right. You expect to go right down to a deeper layer.
It's that. Talk to me about you.
If that's where things are happening.
I was at the grocery store the other day. And of course, again, part of the problem of dressing the way we dress, it's not a problem, but it confuses the language a bit. Mm. Because I said to the cash register girl, how you doing? She goes, well, I had a really rough day.
Oh, and yes.
Like, okay, here we go. Because of course she sees that I'm a priest.
That's true.
And so I felt bad for the people behind us because we
have a session right
now.
We
had a little session.
Yeah. No, it's true. And I feel for people because when you're in social circumstances or when you're at work, you know, that's a totally different social dynamic. Some people don't want their personal stuff really widely known in a work context. And yet at the same time, they feel pretty close to their coworkers.
Yeah.
But those worlds don't really naturally collide or intersect. So it's kind of nice to have them different and a little bit distinct. But when you get into a conversation, people might start asking questions and it feels uncomfortable. That's probably a good indicator right there. When it starts to feel uncomfortable, a certain depth of information, probably better to pause. I always say, when in doubt, choose silence.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can never take the words back.
Right.
You can always go back and say something. It doesn't mean I always follow that advice. I run afoul of it all the time.
Sure.
But yes, I think when in doubt, choose silence. Or in this case, when in doubt, don't overshare. Because it's very difficult to pull that back. And you sometimes walk away feeling uncomfortable.
Right. You're exposed.
You're socially violated, right? Like right. This wasn't right. This wasn't the right context. This person, I'm not comfortable having shared that much with this person. I feel as though I was pressured into oversharing or maybe circumstances drew things out of me and the person didn't want to hear it and I actually did tell them things. And it's just better to choose silence when in doubt.
Agreed. I totally agree with you.
And that there are those layers. Right.
Yeah, explain your analogy there.
So with men in formation and in general and having conversations with people who are looking for some pastoral guidance, I always, you know, say that when talking about levels of disclosure, that you have many layers and appropriately so. And it doesn't mean that we're duplicitous, that the layers betray one another. But in fact, they're just think of it as a deeper color the more you go to the core. And it's okay and appropriate to interact with people at one layer or next, depending on where that relationship has fallen or where it's naturally grown to. But people don't have a right to suddenly insert themselves and go deep.
Right.
That's not appropriate. And you shouldn't feel compelled.
Yeah.
Just because some people are inquiring and some people are pestering. You know, they can be downright pestering about wanting to know about you. And it's flattering to a certain degree. Like, that's nice that you have that interest in me. But on the other hand, whoa.
Yeah.
You know.
It's a voyeur.
Yeah.
Stop looking at my windows at
this
night.
Like, this would take a full year of spiritual direction before I start talking about this. You want, you know, after 2 minutes of meeting you to run right into this. That's a little exaggeration, but still it feels like that way sometimes. So we're an onion, and the onion, it's integral. It's not compartmentalized, but it's just layers that go deeper And we have relationships that hit different layers, and sometimes, and ideally, they grow and they grow deeper. And for some people, you become fast friends. It happens at a quicker pace, and you recognize that that happens so quickly that, hey, there's a unique connection here, because that normally doesn't happen that quickly with someone. Or if there's somebody that stays on the outside for a while, and that's just the way, because socially that's the way it works, and it actually works nice, and it's good to have people just there, because it's exhausting to maintain deep friendships. Yeah. You know, you can't have your 100 best friends. I don't know who can pull that one off.
Exactly.
It's just downright exhausting. I couldn't keep up with the texts.
No.
If that were the case. So, you know, we're meant to have these different layers, and it's not duplicitous, and we're not being false with someone else just because we're at a different layer.
It's always a question that comes up in moral theology class relative to the nature of lying, because you began the discussion by talking about people's right to know, and that was sort of a bifurcation of the topic.
Before you jump in. Mm. So you and I are familiar with this discussion.
That's why I'm going to describe it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just
right to know, like, and lie.
What is a lie? What is a lie? And so there was a time period, and one of the attempts to describe what a lie is that you don't have to give someone information to which they don't have a right. And so when you're speaking, if the person doesn't have a right to the knowledge, you're dissimulating or saying something that's not consonant with the truth.
Deceptive.
It's not a lie, because you're not trying to deceive. But that's not at all what the tradition used to say. That was an attempt by a particular religious order to make good on the fact that someone doesn't have a right to that.
Yeah.
And it gets into all sorts of interesting questions about, you know, wartime and camouflage and espionage,
right,
and a thousand different topics, right? But St. Thomas takes his cue from St. Augustine, and they're pretty severe on it because of the nature of what truth is, and because it's necessary for our salvation, necessary for our freedom, not just the truth of salvation history and the truth of Jesus Christ, but also just speaking the truth with people. If you don't do it, you can't be in a relationship with anyone. And because it's so important, St. Thomas and St. Augustine were quite severe on the fact that you can never, ever say something that's contrary to the truth that's in your mind.
Hmm.
Ever.
Well, you can.
You can. I mean, in terms of possible.
Right.
You're not permitted to,
right,
relative to sin.
Right.
And so they sort of take it out of the realm of whether a person has the right to know. And that's getting back to your point earlier about you don't have to say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can say things that are very clever at times, if you're quick-witted. And I had one wonderful priest one time when we were discussing this, and we're talking about the classic example of moral theology about, okay, it's, you know, it's wartime, World War II, and I have Jews hiding in my basement, and the Nazis come in, are you hiding Jews, right? And so at table, we're going back and forth and all the things you could or could not say,
right,
whatever else. And this priest just looked at us and said, you know, you don't have in this scenario the gift of the Holy Spirit relative to counsel. Like, how do you know what you would do in the moment? Because this is going to require a kind of wisdom that you don't necessarily have in the abstract. And I love that answer,
mm-hmm,
that in the actual situation, it's a real situation with real divine grace,
mm-hmm,
and an appeal to the Holy Spirit, you might just come up with some sort of situation that you could never think of in the abstract that fits the equation.
Right.
And I appreciated that, because it's true. It's what our Lord said about, I will give you the words to speak. But silence is always possible too.
Well, you know, I remember reading a book. It's about these two Protestant women. They were sisters. I think they were somewhere like the Netherlands or Belgium, in that region, Nazi occupation.
Hmm.
They were helping Jewish families, Jewish people on the run, running for their lives. And they were in this situation. They were devoutly Christian. And because they were devoutly Christian, they were not succumbing to the darkness that was befalling their neighbors, particularly their Jewish neighbors. And they wanted to help. And so they were helping. They put themselves in harm's way. And they ultimately ended up in a concentration camp. But I remember a scene, and I apologize for those people who may have read the book and they have a better memory of it than me, but I think this is the gist of it. They had hidden a person behind a panel in the wall when these officers came to the door and precisely asked the question, are you hiding any Jews? And the sisters were fastidious about not doing anything to offend God. Mm. And in particular, the one sister, and she said, oh, we're hiding them in the walls. It came off so ridiculous that the officer heard it as, you know, her being snarky and ridiculous, but she told the truth. And they totally dismissed it, and they checked around the house, and then they left. But it was moment, the grace.
It might be that
she was not going to lie because of her convictions. At the same time, she had the grace in the moment to be able to articulate it in a way that made it sound like a complete jest.
Yeah. There's an example that St. Thomas uses when he's asking the question about the Egyptians and the Hebrew women when Pharaoh told them they had to slaughter all the firstborn, right? Or slaughter all the Jewish boys. And the Hebrew women and the midwives, they didn't conspire together, but clearly they didn't kill them. And so what happens when they ask the midwives what happened, and they said, well, the Hebrew women are just so robust, right? They have these babies,
right?
They
right.
can get there because they didn't want to kill them.
That's right.
And so Thomas asked the question, which is a really interesting question: is God blessing them because they lied? Because it says that God blessed them, and Thomas's answer is he blessed them because of their fear of the Lord. He didn't bless them because of the lie, which is a really good distinction to
make.
Does
it say that she lied? They lied. I mean, they could say, I mean, that could have been true. The women are, but oh, I guess they say they have birth before they get there.
So
there's some of that going on.
Yeah. Well, you know, circling back to your opening statement then, what sort of dissimulation or sort of deflecting is possible and what's not?
Oh, here we go.
And that's a really interesting question.
Call a more theologian. Find the loopholes here.
You know, because we do understand... No, because we do understand the language that we're all using.
That's true.
And so long as it is a common language, we know that that word fine doesn't mean that everything is fine. We know that it means that this is the end of the discussion.
It's like a yellow and a red light in Italy. Everybody knows.
That means go.
If you come to a hard stop, people are going to get killed.
Oh, my heavens, yes. That just means step on the gas.
Yeah. So, no, you're right. I mean, what do these signs really symbolize?
What is the common grammar? Mm-hmm. You know, what else do we normally say in those passing moments? I remember there was a wonderful comedian, I think his name was Regan, and he was talking about the fact that we respond to everything so automatically. We don't oftentimes think about what we're saying. So you're at the airport and you check in your ticket, you hit the little buzzer there and you walk onto the tarmac and the stewardess says, have a nice flight. You say, you too. She's not flying.
Right. But you get the gist, right? You wish them well.
You wish it well, right? Yeah. You wish the person well. So what are the sorts of things do we say that we could analyze to see whether or not in the common vocabulary, it's not being deceptive?
I think if somebody said to me, I'm fine, and I could see tears in their eyes.
Yeah.
I don't think they're lying to me.
Right, they're not.
Right, I think what they're saying is it's not appropriate, or I don't want to impose.
I can get through this.
I can get this, or you know? I'm giving you an out.
Yeah.
So that you don't get into something too heavy with me. So I think you're right. I think that there are ways in which we could read that and understand that they're not being deceptive. They're trying to be gracious. They're trying to give you a gentleman's out, or they're trying to read the room and say what's appropriate. But of course, most of us in that situation, if we saw them, tears in their eyes, we try to pull them aside or you reach out to them regardless of the circumstance, or at least get them to a place where they could be a bit consoled. I think you're right.
We have one seminarian here that when you ask him the question, I think you've worked with him to try to get him to not make an entire self-assessment every time someone says, how are you? Because he wants to answer perfectly honestly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he just stops and he's not afraid of awkward pauses or silences. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the reason we respond so quickly, is that we want to fill the gaps with speech. We don't usually allow for a lot of silence in a conversation. And this individual will just stop and think for a while. It may be a long while.
Right.
And then he might just say, I'm fine. Like
he's really checked in.
He's done a system check.
Yeah. That sounds about right. You know, you're getting an honest response. That is, sure. You know, you got to love the...
it's charming.
The colorful array of personalities that God has allowed us as individuals to possess.
Isn't it true?
It's great to appreciate them when you can. It can be hard sometimes because when you're dealing with somebody who doesn't react or relate to things in the same way you do, it's very difficult to read and communication suffers. And for someone who's social, if you don't have good communication, that creates a very anxious place. You know, we might start speaking too much, or maybe we need to pull away because as a highly social person, I'm not able to communicate. And this puts me in a place I'm not normally in.
Right.
A place where I can't socialize the way that in which I'm comfortable or with the means that I have. And so you run away from it. But to be able to maybe overcome some of that anxiety and to just allow yourself to experience the difference in that person and that character, I think we'd be surprised how much we might truly appreciate or be amused by the other.
Oh, I think so too. I mean, every character is, if it's true that everyone is made in the image of God, it's not exactly the same. I mean, there's an infinite ways in which to reflect the Godhead, right? And so every person is a slightly different manifestation. Certainly the image of God is found in our own capacity to know and to love, but to know and to love as you. And that's slightly different than knowing and loving as anyone else. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking about two things of pedagogical concerns that are interesting or communication concerns that I was once told by a priest when he said, I have a thing that I do in communication with others where if I want them to speak and I want them to sort of speak more and divulge things, I don't think he meant it in a manipulative way. Mm-hmm. He said, I look down at my shoes. And I always remembered that.
And so then, it's a way of indicating that I'm in receiving mode?
I guess so. And you're not in any way aggressive by looking directly at them, certainly not in a position above them. You know, it always happens to be the case and historically when you design offices, furniture, things of that nature, that the important person gets the big chair, right?
Right.
Because it's that posture makes a difference in people's minds sort of subconsciously. And I noticed, I never forgot that, but I was watching in the first year we started the seminary, I was watching our incredible Latin teacher, Dr. Nancy Llewellyn, who is really a singular pedagogue. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's just really incredible at teaching. When she's going around the room and she calls them snap drills, she snaps and then points at someone in sort of a misdirected way to give the answer. So you never know who's going to be called. Yeah. And if you don't get it, she doesn't sit there and stare at you if you're seated and stand over you. She gets smaller and smaller and smaller. Mm-hmm. A really interesting tool, to the point where she's usually on her knees, way beneath you, trying to get you to get the right answer.
Like a beggar.
And eventually, if you still can't get it, she'll shift it over to someone she knows the answer.
I see.
And then you have to repeat it. And when you get it, even though you just copied, parroted, she does an auge, which is, you know, well done kind of a thing.
That's really well done.
And it's really interesting that it so engages the individual to want to get things right. Like we do when we're little kids.
Yeah. You know? So, it's like a puppy wanting the treat. Yeah. At some point you want to give it to them. Yeah. No, that's really well stated. Yeah. And very well done on her part. Well, of course,
she's incredible.
Like there's any surprise in that. She's amazing. All right. So before we go, what do you have in your mind, if anything? I mean, we just entered after the Feast of Pentecost back into ordinary time.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, well, this could be a whole talk at some point, but
I think I know where you're headed.
I mean, we have to talk about this at some point. I discovered the most fun text in reading the Summa in St. Thomas Aquinas. Secunda Secunda, question 168, where Thomas says, it is a vicious thing and sinful to be a bore. So maybe it could be a topic for
yes,
you.
Yes, well, maybe the next one. I applaud
what a great
it.
Line.
A fantastic line from St. Thomas. I think we're going to have to reflect upon that one. Tease it out.
On a more mundane level, do you have anything?
My life is filled with mundane things.
Well, I know. You're the administrator par excellence.
You know, I had we had an event this afternoon at the pastoral center in the diocese where we fed our staff, our 100 people, food and things, to have a little social event. And she said, Father, you need to come down on Thursdays and give out food at the food pantry. And she said it in a way like, you need to come. And as if I'm maybe not giving it its due attention. Mm. And I said, I will. I would like to. That would be nice. And then she said it again. And I said, would you like to come up and do what I'm doing? Because I think 5 minutes, you'd be running down to the food pantry and washing your hands of it. So please do not assume that I'm up in some ivory castle eating bonbons. To be quite honest, give me any day of the week, I'd like to be
isn't
down there
true?
And meeting people and handing things out. Before we go, a little segment to say, appreciate the administrators in your life. I used to say as a kid, I never had to worry about toilet paper being in the bathroom or toothpaste in the cabinet, milk in the fridge. And then as you get older, you realize, that doesn't grow on there.
Exactly.
What happens when you run out? Right. That means, I need money. I got to go and store and get it.
Yeah.
And those practical things. And in retrospect, you realize I was taken care of. Somebody did that work.
Yeah.
Somebody was concerned about it.
Yeah.
Somebody did the ordering. Somebody got into the house. Somebody paid for it. Somebody put it out there. And you just say, that's just growing up and maturing. But in the world of organizations in which we live, that's not dissimilar to administration.
No, it's not. And I find it to some degree to be the same thing with our men. When they get toward the end of their life in seminary, they begin to have a really difficult time. And I think it's because, they're men. They've been men for some time now, but they're not fathers. Mm-hmm. If they want to be in charge of something, they want to have something that they can give themselves to,
be
responsible for. Yeah. And then, of course, we get to our age and it's like,
wait. Yeah, I'm done. I'm happy to
surrender.
I want
to be a grandfather now.
Yep, I'm done. Give me the lounge chair. All right, so we can talk about both of these topics.
Oh,
I think
indeed.
We both hit big topics on the Before We Go segment. So we'll say goodbye and then maybe next time we'll touch on them.
Have a great week.
All right, ciao.
Bless.
Makes me wanna scream from rooftop to the screen.
Thanks for listening to this episode of From the Rooftop.
For updates about new episodes, special guests, and exclusive deals for From the Rooftop listeners, sign up at rooftoppodcast.com.
And remember, for more great ways to deepen your faith, check out all the spiritual resources available at tanbooks.com.
And we'll see you again next time
from the rooftop.